This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 94 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be discussing utopianism in the Star Trek universe. Zachary, how are you, sir?
Mike, I'm doing great. It's great to be recording as usual.
You are in a state of utopia?
I'm in a state of Idaho, but... It's utopian here, in some aspects.
In some ways, yeah.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about utopianism, Mike, and some listeners may know this, and some listeners may not know this, but the literal definition of utopia is no place. That is what the word utopia means. So it's an interesting question about the Star Trek universe. A, whether Star Trek is really utopian in nature. There are a lot of things that are optimistic about our future, but is it right to characterize Star Trek as utopian? And then B, what does the fact that utopianism literally means kind of no place, something that's inherently unattainable, what does that mean for our view of the Star Trek universe and the future of humanity, given that utopianism is by definition something that is impossible to achieve?
You know, it's interesting that you should bring that up. I wasn't aware that that was the literal definition of utopia. However, what I've always
it's from Greek. It literally means no place.
Yeah, and being a Greek scholar, I probably should have known that, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't. But the thing that I find fascinating about how utopia in general is portrayed in the Star Trek universe, you know, a lot of fans feel like Star Trek portrays a utopian future for humanity. And I think that there is a case to be made really for and against that position, because oftentimes our crews find themselves in seemingly utopian societies. And it's almost as though it's a commentary for this dark underbelly of what utopianism can lead to. So I find that very interesting. I'm curious as to how this entire discussion is going to go, because I'm really not sure that I buy into the idea that Star Trek portrays a utopian future. And I certainly don't think that Star Trek has always portrayed it in a positive light.
Well, I think there's two aspects to it. One aspect is whether Federation society is a utopian society. I think arguably Star Trek makes the claim that future human society is better than society in the 20th and 21st century. Mm-hmm. More equality, more opportunity. We've solved the problems of scarcity, economics-wise, things like that. But it's not a perfect society either. There are still wars in the 24th century, the 23rd and 24th century. There still seems to be conflict. There's still a need for a legal structure. We see Starfleet JAG officers, for example, so we know there have to be legal quibbles. And yet, there's progress, and many of the problems of humanity have been solved through technology and through an enlightened view of human nature and what's possible for humanity. So that's one aspect of it, whether we should consider Federation society to be utopian in nature. Whether we think about it as perfect or not, is it something that is obtainable, or does it have this unattainable quality that tends to define utopian societies in literature and in fiction? So the second aspect, I think, is whether there's a dark side to utopianism. And I think where this comes up in Star Trek are alien societies that look like they're utopian in nature, but really, like, as you put it, there's a dark underbelly to them. There's something mm-hmm. wrong in those societies. I kind of joke that Kirk is the great destroyer of utopias in the original series. every time Kirk runs into a society that looks like it's a utopian society, it's usually lacking in some quality that Kirk thinks is important for human nature, freedom or creativity or individuality or something. And Kirk sets himself out to kind of destroy the utopian society and liberate the bound people, you know, from their utopian chains. Picard seems to be more of a preserver of utopias than a destroyer of them. So the contrast between Kirk and Picard's approach to utopian societies, alien societies, in light of the Prime Directive is interesting. But for me, those are the two questions. What do we make a Federation society? Is it utopian in nature? Is it a perfect society, or should we draw attention to the many flaws in 23rd and 24th century Federation society? And then what do the alien societies we see in Star Trek say about the maybe lack of desirability of utopia?
Those are great questions. And I'd like to kind of dive into this by actually looking at it from the perspective of Deep Space Nine. I love Deep Space Nine for a lot of reasons, but one of the things that I really appreciate about Deep Space Nine is how it can, in many ways, be critical of its own universe. And the writers of Deep Space Nine, Ronald D. Moore and Ira Stephen Baer, Robert Hewitt Wolf wrote the teleplay along with Ira Stephen Baer for the episode Paradise Lost. And of course, that was part of a two-part episode where they were really looking at what I think might be a criticism, if you will, of this idea of a utopian society and the Federation being a utopian society. And basically, in many ways, at least partially, the message that I took away from that two-part episode is that the Federation isn't perfect, and it is just as susceptible to the fear-mongering and the politicking that can go on in our own world, that it still has a root even in the future, and that it can wreak havoc in a seemingly utopian society, utopian in irony quotes.
You know, as you were talking about Deep Space Nine, I had this interesting thought that in a way Deep Space Nine is like the middle ground between the original series and The Next Generation. The original series was optimistic, but still showed a lot of flaw in human nature, especially in the relationship between Kirk and McCoy and Spock. And I don't think humans in the 23rd century were quite as idealized as they became in Star Trek The Next Generation in the 24th century. Fast forward to The Next Generation, and you get a very idealized view of human nature. The human crew members on the Enterprise in The Next Generation were very... they weren't perfect, but they were pretty close to it. They didn't have any major flaws. They worked out all their problems. Everything was this nice, polite board meeting and very genteel in a lot of ways. Even when there was strife in the Federation or when there was a danger to the Federation, like with the Borg threat, you didn't really get the sense that humans were the ones causing the problems. And then fast forward to Deep Space Nine, it's almost like Deep Space Nine is, I'm trying to think how to put this philosophically, but it's like the synthesis of the thesis and antithesis of Star Trek, the original series, and Star Trek, The Next Generation. I think of the original series and Next Generation as kind of being polar opposites, mm-hmm. and Deep Space Nine is as bringing trying to put those two things together, the optimism of the next generation combined with sort of deeply flawed characters and not falling back on the idea that humans are idealized. And we get war in Deep Space Nine writ large. There are genuine threats and humans not acting to their best. We get things like Section 31, you know, what's essentially a secret government organization with pretty much unlimited autonomy and power. you know, things we don't tend to associate with a utopian society. So it's interesting to ask whether the Federation society that we see in Deep Space Nine just undermines this, what had hitherto been a very utopian picture of humanity, especially the progression from the original series to the Next Generation.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, one of the interesting lines I think that I find in Paradise Lost is, Sisko says to Admiral Layton, "So you're willing to destroy Paradise in order to save it?" And so I think it's interesting that there's this acknowledgement, certainly, as you pointed out, that in the 23rd century, we've wiped out poverty and we've wiped out hunger, and we've generally become a society that exists to better better mankind and to better the Federation. And so I think there is a general understanding or maybe a general interpretation that the world in the future, the Federation, is a utopia in itself. But what I think is interesting and what I find interesting in Deep Space Nine, certainly, and we see it in a small part in The Next Generation, we see it in a small part even in Voyager, is there, as you mentioned, Section 31, and we see admirals and badmirals and other captains and other Starfleet officers who don't act in the best interest in an evolved way. They don't react to situations that they're in, or they have taken matters in a direction that isn't consistent with the values of the Federation. And certainly that's how it's usually portrayed. You know, I think it's interesting when Sisko says to Layton, "You're willing to destroy Paradise in order to save it." He's calling him out for taking a questionable route in order to preserve the utopia of the Federation. And so I think this raises kind of this interesting question, to what degree are we first willing to go as a society in order to build a utopia, and then what direction are we willing to go in order to preserve it, and what are the possible negative outcomes of that?
Well, I think almost immediately, right off the bat, it's important to recognize, like we said, that Federation society isn't perfect. So there are some areas in which it's more utopian and some areas in which it's less utopian. There's still room for progress, I guess the interesting question for me is whether that insight itself is in line with the Star Trek universe. Is it important in the 24th century that they themselves recognize that they have a long way to go, that they haven't hit the mark yet for a perfectly egalitarian, optimistic utopian society? So I think we should dive into the details a little bit and maybe just do a little classification. Like, what are the areas in which 24th century Federation society has made genuine progress? Where is it more utopian? And where is there still room for improvement and less utopian? So let's list some. What are some ways that 24th century Federation society is utopian and massively better than the 21st century society?
Well, I think right off the bat, I think what would come to mind for most fans is the fact that they have a society that is not driven by capital. I think that comes to mind first, and in many ways, I think that sheer fact that it's not a capitalistic society, obviously, you know, in order to achieve that, they had to wipe out hunger. So we can add that to our list. You know, there's no poverty or hunger.
Yeah, they have Star Trek. They've solved the problem of scarcity, especially with things like replicators, right? Certainly. So there's no material scarcity, and it's not totally clear to me whether that's the case in the 23rd century in the original series. You know, there still seems to be a need for material items. You know, the Enterprise is off and off searching for dilithium and other. Mm-hmm. You know, items that it needs to make the ships go. So, but in the 24th century, it seems like, yeah, the problem of scarcity has been solved. The problems of hunger have been solved. And all of the social ills that go along with those things,
right.
You know, crime and greed and these sort of baser qualities of human nature, sociological problems that are tied to scarcity or tied to poverty seem to have gone away. Are there others? There's definitely racial progress. You don't see issues of race being an issue in the 23rd and 24th century. That's a crucial part of Gene Roddenberry's vision for the future of humanity.
Yeah, most certainly. In fact, I think one of the most powerful lines ever spoken was, you know, Captain Kirk just saying that there was no room for racism on his bridge. There's no room for bigotry on his bridge. That was a powerful line spoken during a critical period of our own country's history.
But, Mike, there was a bigot on the bridge.
There was a bigot on the bridge, but he was ordered to leave his bigotry in his quarters. It definitely would not be an Admiral Archie Bunker.
No, no, no. Okay, so we've got poverty is gone. They've solved the economic problem of scarcity. Racism no longer seems to be a major issue, although there seem to be a couple of racist people in Star Trek, not very many. What else?
I think medically, Zachary, we see advancement, and in particular in the 24th century in the way we approach people with mental health issues, I think is powerful. We see this pop up a couple of times in The Next Generation. We see it pop up a little bit in Voyager, a little bit in Deep Space Nine. I think it's interesting, you know, medically, the advancements that have been made. Because again, I think in the world that we live in today, there are medical issues that have stigmas attached, associated with them. And we've solved this in the future. So that if somebody is suffering from a mental health issue, they're treated and not ostracized. And I think that's powerful.
That's a really good point. Even in the original series, I forget the episode, but there's an episode where there's an enlightened approach to prisons, to you know, criminology, even in the 23rd century.
Yes.
So, you know, down the line, you know, there's an enlightened approach to human psychology. There's an enlightened approach to sociological problems, and there's an enlightened approach to criminal justice that are supposed to be progress compared to what we have in the 20th and 21st century.
Yes.
This is related, but I think it's clear that Federation society benefits from technological advances. So there's definitely kind of a technological utopianism going on inside Star Trek, especially in The Next Generation with all the gadgets, right? It basically, yes. You know, everything's automated. It's super comfortable on the Enterprise D. We joke that it's the USS Hilton. But that's all because of the technology. So all the fears that we associate with technology, you know, artificial intelligence running amok, or, you know, Terminator-like views of technology in the future, that's not really part of the Star Trek universe, with some exceptions like the Borg. But generally, the view is that technology is going to be used for increasing good and increasing the overall well-being of human society without much in the way of fear of technology. So I would classify all the technology in Star Trek as technological utopian.
Yeah, for sure. But it still runs amok enough to keep Geordi busy. So
yeah, once in a while you get sentient holograms, you know, running amok in the holodeck and taking over the ship. And
yes,
you know, you gotta hang out in, you know, Moriarty's living room, drinking tea and eating crumpets and trying to stay alive.
Yeah, but, you know, without Moriarty, what fun would it be, right?
Well, I would say there's progress in terms of education. We've talked about this before. In fact, we did an entire episode of Metatrex on the philosophy of education in Star Trek. You know, we have young children taking calculus. So clearly there have been improvements in the education system in the 24th century. So that's utopian to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very plausible, I think, you know, teaching kindergartners calculus, but, you know, that's what they say in Star Trek.
That It is for sure. I don't know, apart from a Dr. Bashir style enhancement, how that's possible, but evidently it is.
You raise an interesting point that to what extent should we put limits on this quest for endless human improvement? In the 24th century, they've apparently decided that that kind of genetic engineering is taking human improvement too far, which is completely arbitrary to me because there are so many other ways in which humanity has improved in the 24th century using technology and using medicine and using psychology and using sociology and all the things we've been talking about. So why is genetic engineering so bad in light of all those other ways of messing with humanity? But they've apparently themselves decided that certain approaches to creating utopian society themselves aren't healthy. Either they're intrinsically wrong because of some virtues of human nature that we don't want to lose, or there's a risk to them like the eugenics wars.
Well, and I think in the Star Trek universe, this does point directly back to the eugenics wars and the tragedy that came out of that. And so those limits were put in place because of this negative history that they had with genetic improvements. And I think there's something to that for our own world. Oftentimes the lessons that we learn and the limits that we've placed on things in our own world today are as a result of negative consequences of those actions in the past. And so I think it's interesting in the Star Trek universe, here's something that could potentially help humanity. I mean, you know, we're introduced to some characters who have benefited from genetic enhancement, Dr. Bashir being chief of the tribe here. And in many ways, even though we are able to produce something positive, there's still a moratorium on it because of the potential for abuse and negative consequences. So I find that fascinating.
Well, I think that's a good segue into the non-utopian aspects of 23rd and 24th mm-hmm. century Federation society. There's a constant danger of humanity moving in that direction, you know, over-engineering itself to the point where you end up with something like the eugenics wars. Something that came immediately to mind in thinking of education in Star Trek is the fact that Captain Picard has to remind Wesley Crusher of the virtues of the liberal arts, thinking about philosophy rather than focusing purely on engineering and starship operations and all the technological stuff that needs to be learned in the 24th century. There's a human quality, the interests and the virtues that make up who we are as a species, the kinds of things we're able to think about that other species don't seem to be able to think about, if they think at all. I think it's clear that not everyone in the 24th century finds those things valuable. So there's a danger of these uniquely human elements of human nature being lost in a technological society. And that's one of my favorite conversations in all of Star Trek is the conversation between Captain Picard and Wesley Crusher. In fact, we use a clip from it in the opening credits to Metatrex.
Yes.
When Captain Picard says there's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy, and Wesley Crusher just doesn't get it.
Right.
And, you know, Captain Picard has to remind him that those things are important. And those are things that have to be passed down from generation to generation to generation. Otherwise, they will be lost in light of human progress. So that's one thing. You know, there's a danger to the education system. What are some other ways in the 24th century that Federation society is non-utopian? The presence of wars, I think, is an obvious one. They have not solved the problem of wars. It's not a global war, but an interstellar war, intergalactic war, you know, one part of the galaxy warring with another part of the galaxy, the Federation warring with the Klingons or the Romulan Empire or the Cardassians or the Borg. And when you start to add all those things up, it doesn't sound like a utopian society at all. It sounds like there's war is at the Federation's doorstep and on every one of its borders.
Yeah, they seem to have solved it within the confines of the Federation. We're not seeing anywhere in the Star Trek universe where, you know, all of a sudden the Andorians have left the Federation or the Vulcans or the Tellarites. So there seems to be You know, there seems to be a strong bond within the Federation. It's these worlds you mentioned, the Romulan Star Empire, the Klingons, the Dominion, these outer fringe species outside of the Federation seem to be the ones that we haven't quite figured out how to get along with.
What do you think would cause Vulcan to secede from the Federation?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You've stumped me.
Because Vulcans, even though they're you know, uber rigid about logic, they're pretty tolerant of illogical humans, all things considered.
They really are, and that's why I honestly can't think of anything, because I think in many ways, in all seriousness, I mean, all joking aside, I think that in many ways, what we've seen within the Star Trek universe, we've tested that relationship, I think, about as many ways as possible.
It's like us and England, or us and France. You know, we think of ourselves in the nowadays as partners in liberty, although that's being challenged a little bit in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. But you know, those are longstanding relationships that aren't likely to change. And I think that's probably true of Earth and Vulcan in the 24th century.
Yeah. So I think it's entirely possible that we can solve this somewhere out there, you know, maybe we'll find out in Star Trek Discovery that we've solved this in the way distant future, but somehow I don't think so.
Well, I am really curious about this. This is the most exciting development in Star Trek Discovery for me. The fact that they're finally going forward in time again in Star Trek, which it always bothered me that people wanted to keep turning to the past. I'm one of these people that think Star Trek should look to the future. And despite what I said about Captain Picard reminding Wesley Crusher about philosophy, I think, you know, looking to the future with the past in mind is more important than constantly returning to the past. That's my view on it. Will 29th century Federation society be even more utopian than 24th century society, or will new problems have emerged? Will it be arguably a recognizable society? I guess my concern about thinking of Federation society as utopian is that all of the problems that we're talking about in Federation society in the 24th century are problems that are familiar to us in the 21st century and were familiar to humanity 2,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago. So from that long-term perspective of human history, in what sense is there really progress, or in what sense can we think of Federation society as being utopian when all of the problems we're about to talk about are completely recognizable to us today?
And we could speculate. We could certainly sit here for the rest of the podcast and speculate about what they might give us in the third season of Discovery. I just have to kind of give them props because, you know, as fans have been screaming, you know, enough of this looking into the past, let's get to the future. They kind of put this huge exclamation point on it. They went to the distant future for this. So I am curious to see what the future Federation society might look like, if it even exists. They may get there and it doesn't exist, and so they have to reestablish those principles. I don't know.
You mean you don't want to see the Enterprise K?
I think we'd be like on Enterprise X or YZ or so.
I don't know. Each one is supposed to last like 100 years or something, right? They just always get destroyed before that.
Exactly. I was going to say that they always get destroyed.
So before we move on, let's talk about a few more ways in which the 24th century society is imperfect. Mm-hmm. So we've talked about wars. We've talked about the danger of eugenics. We've talked about dangers in a technological society. What are some other imperfections of 24th century society?
I just want to say, too, speaking to the dangers of a technological society, I think we see a lot of great examples of this in the Star Trek universe. I think about Barclay's abuse of the holodecks.
Yeah, holo addiction.
Holo addiction.
So addiction's a problem in the 24th century. Yeah, that much is clear.
Most certainly. And I think that speaks to an addiction that we're dealing with in our own society today, as more and more people are living lesser quality lives because of addiction to social media. And so I think that's a very real thing that we can gain some insight and inspiration from the Star Trek universe.
One of the most insightful things that Barclay ever said, and I think it's insightful because it is completely on the nose, and any Star Trek fan that really thinks of themselves as a Star Trek fan should take this to heart. Barclay says, "I've lost myself in Voyager." we can become addicted to Star Trek.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge danger of fandom that people don't take seriously, that people can become addicted to their fandom and forget about the rest of life.
Yeah, for sure. That's a great point.
So addiction is a problem. What other psychological or sociological or civil or governmental or technological problems are there in the 24th century? There's still a need for counselors. So, you know, humans have improved. They have a more enlightened approach to counseling, but they haven't evolved to the point where we don't need counselors anymore.
Most certainly. Most certainly.
Would that even be a good thing? Would it be a good thing to evolve to that point where we're all psychologically self-sufficient and don't need counselors or psychiatrists or psychologists?
Yeah, well, I think the same point could be made for admirals and captains and...
or doctors, or pick your favorite, you know, humanitarian role in Star Trek. You know,
yeah.
Wouldn't it be better not to need those things in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, in a truly utopian society, would captains need admirals? Would a crew need a captain?
Geordi would be more like the Maytag repairman.
Yeah. I just had a mental picture of Geordi in that repairman.
Yeah,
costume.
Maytag repairman with a visor, sitting around waiting for something to break. You know, but the ship fixes itself at this point. So, you know,
yeah.
What does he do?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So there are things that are imperfect, but what are the dark sides of 24th century Federation society? You know, you mentioned a dark underbelly. Section 31 is one of them.
I think Section 31 is a large one, and it's something that I think is carried over from our own, you know, I mean, Star Trek was kind of born out of the Cold War era, and this is kind of an interesting carryover, I think, that... What I find really interesting about Section 31 in Star Trek is that we didn't really have Section 31 in the original series. So the original series was the entity of Star Trek that was born out of the Cold War. We don't have a Section 31. We don't really get a Section 31 until much, much later. We didn't even really have it in Next Generation, really, until the movie era.
Well, I want to object to something, because it's easy to say, well, they didn't have Section 31 in the 23rd century, at least not in the original series.
Yeah, I'm not saying they didn't exist.
Well, if it wasn't a thing, right? It wasn't mentioned in the original series. It's something that we're kind of retconning into the 23rd century and into the original series from what we saw in Deep Space Nine and now Discovery. But Gene Roddenberry himself thought of Star Trek as a wagon train to the stars. Mm-hmm. He thought of it more as cowboys and Indians, you know, out there in the Wild West, being on the frontier. Even though it had these utopian aspects, it was humans out there on the frontier with all of the challenges and dangers and excitement and drama and imperfections of being on the frontier. And that's what makes for good drama. And that's why it made an interesting TV show. So... it's tempting to say, well, they didn't have that in the 23rd century. And then in the Next Generation, they didn't have it either, even though we know it was there, you know, in canon. But certainly Federation society wasn't portrayed that way in the Next Generation. But that seems to conflict with the description of Star Trek as a wagon train to the stars. You know, I think of that as meaning, you know, we're out here on the Oregon Trail with Indians shooting at us all the time, and we have to negotiate with these Indians. So, you know, that doesn't sound like a utopian society to me when put in those terms.
Yeah, sure. And a point well taken. And I'm certainly not suggesting that Section 31 didn't exist. We just didn't see them. So I just find it interesting that we've kind of reinserted in many ways this covert arm of the Federation later on in the Star Trek universe. I find that in and of itself really fascinating.
Well, I think that itself is a really good segue into my next question that I have, is whether we ourselves as fans really believe in the utopian aspects of what we see in future human society in Star Trek. The fact that a great many number of fans really like the idea of Section 31. It excites them. They think it's a necessary component of 23rd and 24th century Federation society to maintain the kind of optimism and utopianism and all these positive qualities that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast. A great many fans say, yeah, of course it's obvious there has to be something like Section 31 with all of those imperfections in order to maintain that. To me, that says that even hardcore Star Trek fans that love the optimistic vision of the future of humanity fundamentally don't believe it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that fundamentally they don't believe it. They don't believe that it's possible. And I think the fans that find Section 31 interesting, I would be interested to find out what it is that they find so fascinating specifically about Section 31. I think that would be telling, probably more so than the fact that they just simply like Section 31. I mean, what is it that makes it so attractive?
Yeah, I don't want to start a Section 31 flame war, but I would be at the other end of the spectrum. I find it about the most boring concept in all of Star Trek. I cannot stand Section 31 plot lines. I don't find it interesting. I do find the question that it raises interesting, whether it's a necessary component of the optimistic society we see. But I guess just to really press our faith in the Star Trek universe a little bit, does the fact that we say, yeah, of course there are going to be problems in the 24th century. Of course there are going to be wars. Of course there are going to be greedy people. Of course there are going to be psychological problems. Of course we won't have solved all of the challenges of human nature. Those things are going to keep recurring and recurring and recurring, just as they've done throughout human history, no matter what kinds of progress have been made on any fronts. Does that mean that we really just fundamentally believe that the constant in the trajectory of human history is not progress, but more of the same? It'll basically be ancient Rome with phasers and with starships. And this is, in a way, this was the interesting thing about the Romulans, right? The way the Romulans are portrayed in the original series is that they were Romulans, like taken from Rome, right? Named after Romulus, yeah, the founder of Rome, right? This is a completely obvious reference. It's not even subtle. I think.
And Remus.
Yeah, I think part of that is showing that even in the future, there will be essentially a primitive society like ancient Rome, with all of the political challenges and all of the social challenges and all of the challenges to human nature, that those things are not going to be weeded out even in the 23rd century.
Yeah, and then there's this interesting criticism that we get from the episode of Deep Space Nine. I think it's in the fifth season, Let He Who Is Without Sin. And we've talked about this episode actually a few times here on Metatrex. But the interesting criticism that this episode seems to have is that there is a potential for mankind to become soft in a utopian society.
Yeah, I mean, they should be more like the Klingons. They don't even put padding down when they go to sleep at night, right? But Kirk isn't soft.
No, I mean, Kirk isn't soft.
He might be an overbearing dictator with delusions of godhood, but he's not soft. And the Enterprise might be a garbage scow.
Say, what did you say?
It's going to come to blows right here on Metatrex.
It's going to come to blows right here on Metatrex.
See, we're already devolving back into our baser, more animalistic, Thomas Hobbesian state of nature approach to things, Mike.
Yeah, and so I think there are a couple of dangers there. You know, we're talking a little bit about the dark underbelly. I think the potential for mankind to become soft in a utopian society, and to become susceptible to a dominion or, you know, a Klingon society that isn't by any definition soft, I think that is a real danger and something to be considered.
Or a charismatic political candidate who, stirs the passions of the conservative aspects of 24th century society and becomes president of the Federation.
I think you're absolutely right.
To put just a fine, you know, slightly fine point on it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And isn't that what we see a little bit of in Paradise Lost with Admiral Layton and this sort of coalition that he's come up with? I mean, he's got a president that, let's just be honest here, he's not the strongest leader in the Star Trek universe. He does seem kind of wishy-washy, and this Dominion threat.
Yeah, he's Jimmy Carter. I mean, it's not that Jimmy Carter is spineless because he's a wonderful human being, but, you know, pretty ineffective president.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I think that's probably a fair assessment.
Jarish, I can't think of a better analogy. You know, a nice guy who means well and has a great vision, but doesn't know how to use the power of the office.
Yeah, Jarish is a very nice guy, and he's a very intelligent being. But for these trying times that they're in, you know, he was a little wishy-washy, and he didn't want the responsibility, I think, to make these kinds of decisions for the Federation.
Well, does that tell us that even in the 24th century, there will be a pull back towards an increase in political power as opposed to a democratization of society?
It's a great question.
I think that's a danger in our society. We're seeing it now with President Trump, honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think it's an interesting question whether as society improves, as we get technological improvements, as we get periods of peace, like we see in the time period before the Dominion War, when humanity does get a little soft and comfortable, when something goes wrong, will there be a kind of pendulum swing politically back towards a more conservative approach to political power?
Well, and then at one point, does that become something more like Landru, where it's, you know, we're just on autopilot with, you know, some type of artificial intelligence calling the shots?
So I'm not quite sure how to ask this, but does that mean that there will be a genuine improvement in the 24th century with an increasing need for vigilance to prevent that pendulum swing? Or will it be more of the same? Is it more like ancient Rome in the 24th century and all of the problems and a genuine lack of progress because all of those ills persist even into the 24th century? I'm not sure if I phrased that in the best possible way, but I hope you see the distinction I'm getting at. Will there be genuine progress with a need to be vigilant, or will there be a complete lack of progress because all of the same problems exist in the 24th century?
I think you phrased that fine. And honestly, I would love to kind of kick that question out to our listeners to jump in and help us answer this question in the Babel Conference. I think it would be a great discussion point for our listeners in the Babel Conference under our show thread.
What's interesting to me as a philosopher is the fact that what we're having right now is essentially the same discussion that happened 2,500 years ago inside Plato's Republic, when Socrates is describing Plato through Socrates in the form of the dialogue, is outlining what he thought of as a utopian society, the perfect way that society could be organized around the concept of justice. And one of his interlocutors, I can't remember whom off the top of my head, basically makes the objection that this is a great vision, Socrates, but it's completely impractical. It's utopian. It's not possible. You know, the human nature is not like that. So what's the point of developing this idealized vision of what human society could be when it's not possible to achieve it? And Plato, through Socrates, as a mouthpiece in the dialogue, basically says, well, it gives us a vision for what to strive for. It's important to have the ideal. Even if it's impossible to achieve the ideal, we need to have the ideal to aim towards, even if we know very consciously that we'll never achieve it to its fullest extent. That's basically Socrates' response. And in light with Plato's view of the nature of reality being shaped around idealized or perfect forms, and the physical world that we live in with all of its flaws is sort of an imperfect shadow of these more idealized forms, that's part mm-hmm. of Plato's metaphysics. But So for me, I think of Star Trek as kind of a platonic ideal, similar to Plato's Republic. It might be something that we'll never be able to achieve. I think it's when you really press most Star Trek fans, they'll have to admit that they're not optimistic that we will solve all of the problems of humanity in the near or far future. But it's important to have an ideal to strive towards, even if we know we'll never achieve it. And I think the problems that we see in the 24th century betray the fact that, there are going to be more problems in the 24th century than we'd like to believe as Star Trek fans. So what do you think about this, Mike? What role does the vision of the Star Trek universe and the vision of human nature that we see in Star Trek play if we're willing to admit that we'll never be able to achieve it in any measurable degree, if the problems of humanity will persist? Why do we get so excited about it? And why do we say that we really believe in Gene Roddenberry's vision of an optimistic future for humanity when in the very next sentence we're like, yeah, except for all the stuff that's going to be wrong because those things aren't going to change about human nature? What's the point of having that optimistic utopian vision when we don't have any actual faith in it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that, because I think it's probably the most important question in this whole discussion. And quite simply put, I think that it's important that we have something to reach for. I'm a reader, and I think that the world is a better place when pages turn. And a writer. I think the world is a better place when pages turn and people dream. And I think that dreaming is a very important exercise. It allows us to shape something with which we can, as an individual or even as a society, we reach towards that, and we try to improve ourselves to a degree that would help us get closer to that. Now, some would say that an idealized utopian idea of the future, because it's unattainable, we really should shy away from that. But I disagree with that to some measure, because I think that having something that we can constantly reach toward, I think, is important for the drive of human ambition. But at the same time, I think we have to be very vigilant as a society not to allow ourselves to settle. And I think that was the case for Beta 3. I think in Return of the Archons, their world was torn by war. I think it was something like 4000 BC. You know, their world was literally tearing itself apart. And so the leader at that time, he was an engineer, he was a philosopher, he creates this artificial intelligence, and he uses it to control that society. And in fact, I think one of the lines from Return of the Archons, I think it was Rieger, I believe was his name. He said, there was war and the world was destroying itself, and Landru saw the truth. He changed the world. I think we have to be vigilant not to just buy into cheap, easy solutions and cheap, easy believism in order to solve the world's problems. I think a utopian ideal is important because we need to reach for that, not to trade it for something cheap and easy.
Well, for me, this discussion is illuminating and allowing me to articulate some of the problems that I've had with the type of storytelling we see in Star Trek Discovery. And to some extent, Star Trek Enterprise to a lesser extent. I think in showing the dark sides of Federation society, in delving into all of the issues that we see, to the extent that Star Trek storytelling does that, is the extent to which it is failing to show that optimistic, utopian, idealistic vision to strive towards. And maybe not. I think you could easily read it the other way. You know, some people might say, well, no, it's not. It's showing that there's still room to grow. It's showing that even in the 24th century, there's something to strive for and something to get beyond, and that will never go away. And that's going to be a part of human nature. And we're going to keep pushing through all those challenges. And for me, I think the next generation, frankly, does a better job of showing something like a Platonic vision of what human nature could be, more so than Discovery and more mm-hmm. so than Enterprise, again, to a lesser degree. But I know I'm speaking in metaphors here, Mike, because that's sometimes these metaphors I think are really enlightening. In crafting something like Plato's Republic or something like the utopian version of 24th century society that we see in the next generation, is that more like building a dam? Building a sculpture, you know, planning and building and engineering, social engineering we're talking about in this case, I think, right? Or is it more like plugging all of the holes in the dam where you put your finger in one hole and then another leak pops out over here and you try to plug that one with your hand and, you know, another leak starts down by your foot and you got to plug that one with your foot. You know, is that what 24th century is going to be like? You just solve one problem and another one's created. You try to solve that one and boom, it pops out another problem over here. Are we just, you know, dam pluggers? Or are we societal engineers trying to build, you know, this great society as an edifice, kind of like Johnson and the Great Society in the 20th century?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's interesting. We keep pointing to Star Trek The Next Generation as this example of utopia. And the reality is they lived in a bubble, right? And so oftentimes what we find in Star Trek The Next Generation is they keep encountering problems. Some of them are within the Federation and some of them are outside the Federation. Sometimes they're on their own ship. I mean, one minute they're attending, a symphony on,
so much for the loss of culture in the 24th century.
Yeah.
They may not read philosophy, but they listen to a lot of classical music.
They like the classics, and you can't fault them for that. But I think it's interesting, you know, one scene they're sitting there listening to a classical concert, and, you know, the next minute they're arming photon torpedoes. So I don't think that Star Trek The Next Generation gives us a picture of utopia per se, because oftentimes I think we see Star Trek The Next Generation in the bubble of what's going on Captain Picard's well-oiled machine.
You don't even get any countercultural space hippies in the 24th century. Where's all the counterculture? Where's the avant-garde, you know, media and music and film? You know, where are people pushing the boundaries in the 24th century?
Yeah, there are no boundary pushing.
They just repaint Mondrian paintings and listen to classical music. And, you know, who's creating something new, for gosh sakes?
And I think that's honestly, all kidding aside, I think, Zachary, that's an interesting question that's relevant to our discussion.
Well, I think it's really relevant, because I think what the 20th century has shown us, even though this was always true in the form of revolutions, but I think the 20th century and now 21st century have shown us that counterculture moves humanity forward, right? You need people that are rebels. You need people that are willing to break the rules. You need people who are going to, you know, not sit in the back of the bus, and they're going to plunk themselves down at the counter and eat their meal, and they're not going to use the colored restroom, and they're going to sing Kumbaya in the woods, and they're not going to dress like those stiffs want us to dress.
Gabriel Bell.
Right, they're exactly, and those people move humanity forward as much as any technologist or any politician, right? You know, those people are the people that we point to and go, they changed the game on us. And so, who's doing that in the 24th century?
Yeah, all we really get is Captain Picard. Just every once in a while, he's just like, let go of my utopia.
Yeah, and it's a fairly homogenized society. So I have to believe that there's a countercultural element in the 24th century somewhere.
Right.
Either politically in a very relevant way or culturally in the form of new media.
So somehow, though, I think Picard's famous "the line must be drawn here" line, I think applies.
The line must be drawn at space hippies this far and no further.
This far and no further. Let go of my utopia. There'll be no pushing boundaries on this bridge, Mr. Crusher.
Really, I mean, what is the closest thing we see to counterculture in The Next Generation?
Wow.
Who breaks the rules the most?
Data.
No.
Think about this for a second. I mean, Zachary, he created an offspring. And look at the controversy that wrought. I mean, they basically called him in and berated him for not getting their approval before he created an offspring.
All he has to do is play him some Vivaldi on his violin and he's going to pacify them.
But don't you find that interesting that the most vanilla character, I think maybe even in the history of Star Trek, is Data, and yet he was in some ways the boundary pusher. He was the one making us, basically forcing us to redefine what it means to be alive and who has rights. And
yeah, several times. Creates, there's the Measure of a Man. There's the episode with Lowell. Yeah, okay. But I don't think of Data as being very counterculture, though. I mean, he may stand up for what's right, but he's not very counterculture.
Yeah, he's not, but yet oftentimes he's used in that manner, and I think that's telling of The Next Generation. I think that I see, and this is my criticism, I think, of Star Trek: The Next Generation. I'm going to get hate over this. I just know it, but this is my criticism of Star Trek: The Next Generation. It doesn't push the boundaries. And while I find a lot of it philosophically interesting, I don't think that it deals very well with this topic.
Right. I completely agree. Let's move on to Deep Space Nine really quickly. Deep Space Nine is better at pushing the boundaries. It deals with a lot of things that The Next Generation barely scratches the surface on. What is the countercultural element in Deep Space Nine?
Interestingly enough, I think oftentimes it is the Bajoran society, their religious beliefs that are counter to the Federation.
That's a great point. I didn't think of Bajoran spirituality as being the 24th century equivalent of Kumbaya in the woods.
Yeah, but in many ways it is. And that really, in a lot of ways, Zachary, from the very first episode to the very last, is kind of this overarching theme within Deep Space Nine.
Kira is a great example of someone who has to be a bit more militant in her counterculture. She has to go against her own Bajoran beliefs in a lot of ways, and she's constantly in a hostile position towards the Federation for a lot of reasons. So, you know, she has to be I guess counterculture and a little militant and aggressive on both fronts. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and I was literally getting ready to say the fact that Kira, when we first meet her, is not very far removed from her life as a terrorist. And what I really find fascinating is not just the way the Federation, I think, influenced her for the good, but perhaps in many ways, the way she influenced the Federation, and in particular, I think Sisko, and challenged him in ways, I think, that made him more formidable, oftentimes as a voice of challenge to the Federation.
One of the last things I want to talk about, Mike, is the difference between Kirk and Picard as it relates to utopias. We made the point at the beginning of the podcast that Kirk is the destroyer of utopias. Kirk will stumble upon a society that looks like it's perfect. It's agrarian, or it's, you know, use technology to solve problems, seemingly perfect society. But it turns out that the society is lacking in some quality that Kirk thinks is important, human mm-hmm. freedom or individuality or fill in the blank. And Kirk pulls the plug on the society, or at least attempts to enlighten them with a very inspiring, you know, Picard gets a lot of press for all the speeches, but Kirk has some great speeches.
Oh yeah.
about human nature as it relates to a seemingly utopian society wearing a mask. Whereas Picard is more of a preserver of utopias, you know, we get a much greater emphasis on the Prime Directive in the 24th century.
Certainly.
And Picard is willing to preserve an imperfect society for the sake of preserving that cultural, some sense of like cultural purity, not in a eugenics kind of sense, but in the sense of each culture having its own beauty and its own virtues and its own reasons for preserving, whether or not the Federation agrees with them, whether we think they're virtuous, that it's up to that society to be who they are, to learn their own lessons, to develop as they see fit, and it's not our job to interfere with them. And I think the Next Generation makes that point again and again and again and again, almost ad nauseum, really. But those two views directly contradict each other, right? Kirk's willingness to interfere for the sake of what he thinks of as virtuous is completely contradictory with Picard's approach, which is preserving those cultures, whether or not they happen to be in line with Federation values. So it's an interesting question, which approach is the right one, most in line with Federation society, most in line with the utopian nature of the 24th century? You know, should we be destroyers of utopias? And I think Kirk's view is that we actually create a more utopian society if we unmask the fake utopias.
Yeah.
Whereas Picard is like, nope, you know, we're just not going to interfere. It's not our job. Prime Directive. And that's my job as a captain, not my business. I'm just curious what you think of as the, maybe not the right approach, but what's your take on that dichotomy?
You know, I think it's interesting in that I don't necessarily think that, I mean, utopia aside, I think what we see here are two completely different men with two completely different philosophies. And again, has nothing to do with utopia, but I think I would have been interested to see Captain Picard and what his reaction would be to Dr. Daystrom's M5 computer. I mean, if we would have installed the M5 on the Enterprise D, I think I would have been interested to see how Picard handled that, because Captain Kirk, he wasn't happy about it at all. And you know, and I think this is indicative of his character. I think he distrusts, inherently distrusts anything that isn't human. And I think in many ways he sees these utopian societies as something that's not carefully guided by a human hand. And so I think that there's inherently a distrust there for Captain Kirk, but that's not so with Captain Picard. And maybe in some ways it's not just the writing of the character, but maybe it's telling of the way society has evolved, and that Captain Picard is a little more trusting of technology because we're 100 years removed from Captain Kirk. Maybe that's the issue here.
I guess I don't think of this as a technological question of their views on technology. I think of it as an issue about their views of human nature. Like, and maybe I'm overemphasizing the differences. Like when Kirk says, "I need my pain," maybe that really is the same thing as Captain Picard basically saying, "Well, we learn from our mistakes and we fail and we learn, and that's what makes us who we are and that's how we grow." Maybe those really are saying the same thing, but their approaches are so different.
Yes.
But I think both of them would say that there's a danger when you try to engineer a perfect society. In fact, we do see this because the Next Generation episode, The Masterpiece Society, we see what's essentially an engineered society, and Captain Picard doesn't like it very much. He basically says they've weeded out all of the things that they've taken out all the challenge. They've weeded out the things that he thinks of as important and virtuous for humans. That's how humans grow and learn, by struggling and failing and, you know, not being perfect. And And Captain Kirk does much the same thing. When he runs into a seemingly perfect society, he's quick to unmask it too. So maybe I'm overemphasizing their differences. I just think Captain Picard is a bit more hesitant to interfere, where Captain Kirk is willing to give an inspirational speech and flip the switch on the machine, whatever the machine is, whether literal or metaphorical, and destroy the seemingly perfect society and try to make them more in line with his own view. Kirk is more of an engineer, a social engineer, than Picard in that put in those terms.
Yeah, and again, I keep going back to Return of the Archons, but I think there's something brilliant about that episode, and I think what it says about Kirk's general skepticism, I think is the word, for utopian societies. He wants to stay and figure it out. He wants to find out who's behind the curtain he generally distrusts utopian societies.
That's a great point. He's the one going, where's the wizard? Yeah. Why does God need a starship? Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And that's certainly not Captain Picard. Great place. Good to see you all, and we'll be moseying along now. I mean, in the episode Justice, I think it's interesting until Wesley gets himself into some trouble. They were generally very enthusiastic about what they were seeing with this, these perfect physical specimens and this perfect society, and they were pretty enthusiastic about it until Wesley got in trouble, and all of a sudden messing up some flowers brings the death penalty.
That's a really great example, because to me it's interesting to ask what Kirk would have done if Kirk had been in Picard's shoes in that episode. While Picard gives a very inspirational speech about what's wrong with the society, he doesn't really try to change the society in any meaningful way. He just wants his people out of there. He doesn't go out on a crusade trying to get the people to change, right? Whereas I think Kirk would give a speech and it would be inspirational, but the goal of Kirk's speech would be to get the society to change.
Well, I mean, Picard's line from that episode was, "Let's hope it's not too good to be true." I mean, he's going into this pretty optimistically. I mean, let's hope it's not too good to be true. And Geordi, all he can think about is sex. He just, man, they make love at the drop of a hat, any hat.
Worf, he's like, "Nice planet,
nice planet."
Worf's my favorite TNG character, by the way.
No.
Yeah, he is. Well, have we reached any conclusions about utopianism? I guess my overall view is just that the society we see in Star Trek is not as utopian as we like to think it is, and most Star Trek fans don't believe in it as much as they would like to think they do.
I generally agree with that. I generally agree with that sentiment. I think challenged, even the Star Trek fan who is just adamant that they believe in this utopian society, I think if they're challenged, I think if they have to answer for some of these episodes like Justice, like Paradise Lost, Let He Who's Without Sin, we talked about Return of the Archons and other episodes of Star Trek today on Metatrex. I think if challenged, oftentimes it would be difficult, I think, for most fans to really give an answer that supported a real belief in this idea of utopia. That's not to say, Zachary, that I don't think we shouldn't strive. We most certainly should. I think, again, it's important that we dream. I think that Star Trek is important to us as fans for us to have something that we can reach for. And I think that was Gene Roddenberry's intent. Now, whether he drank his own Kool-Aid or not, I think remains to be seen. But I think that he gave us something to reach for. I think that Star Trek represents a dream that he had of something that, yeah, it may be unattainable, but we should by all means shoot for it.
Yeah, and this is something I would like to see the creators of Star Trek really take to heart. The fact that Star Trek serves this role as providing that utopian vision in a way that's analogous to Plato's Republic. It provides an ideal to strive toward, and the extent to which they deviate from the ideal. And I recognize you have to do that for dramatic purposes. They had to do that in the original series. They had to do it in the Next Generation to some extent. And every iteration of Star Trek has deviated from it. And you have to do that for dramatic reasons. But to the extent to which you deviate from it is the extent to which you're failing to provide that ideal to strive towards. And I would just like to see a better balance between good drama and that kind of utopian platonic ideal for what society could be. I think we desperately need it in the 21st century. I think you know, we ourselves in the 21st century aren't as optimistic about those things in general as we were in the 20th century, having gone through the Cold War and having gone through September 11th and having gone through a couple more wars and having gone through all the political strife. You know, we're in need of that ideal. Yes. More so now than ever. But also recognizing that it's just an ideal, that, you know, that those problems are going to plague humanity, you know, for the foreseeable future, hundreds or thousands of years in the future, that those problems aren't going to go away. So we don't want to overemphasize those idealistic aspects either. But most importantly, Mike, we have to ask the question we asked a little while ago: where are the 24th century space hippies? That's what we really need if you're going to have progress in the 24th century, right? Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about 24th century space hippies and utopianism in the Star Trek universe, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on Trek FM, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
I'm not sure that our mindset has necessarily changed drastically from 1993 to 2019. Perhaps it has. I think it has a bit. But the tendency for this kind of thing to happen may have been there then, but the difference is that today we have these platforms like Twitter and Facebook that amplify it, and it is much easier for people to get together into these groups and push a certain agenda or attack an individual.
Melodic Treks.
But I did actually look back to a lot of the older stuff, like the Jerry Goldsmith scores and even like the James Horner scores. I thought the orchestration style, like, I thought was really, really cool to me. Kind of had this more classical, like using only the orchestra, but creating these spooky textures and stuff. I always really loved that kind of sound.
Literary Treks.
And all of a sudden, we see a panel that shows where Kirk and Crisp are. I want to call her Crispy for a second.
There's Spock and Crisp, I think, right?
Okay. That, yeah, Spock and Crisp. I love that cereal. And I had some Kellogg's Spock and Crisp the other day.
Warp 5.
You don't give them the tools they need moving forward. It's great to give someone their freedom, but you have to then stay there and help them to get to the next step so that they don't need you anymore. To do that was the problem with the episode, and I think that plays a big role in not just this episode but society in general. We've done that a lot in other countries, and we've gone and knocked out regimes and, you know, whatever, and then we don't do anything for the people there, so we're back in the same boat or a worse boat than we were when we started.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode of MetaTreks, and there are many ways for you to mind-meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Mike, speaking of contact information, when you're not pushing the boundaries of 24th century avant-garde film, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the TrekFM network?
Well, Zachary, I'm on Facebook. That's where I'm most active. Certainly, you can catch me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. You can also catch me on my website, hannahgoodhart.com or cmichaelmorrison.com. Zachary, when you're not off destroying utopias, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and on the network?
You can't destroy what never existed, Mike. Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You're welcome to find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/TrekFM. That's patreon.com/TrekFM to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/TrekFM. Well, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the most effective unmasker of false utopias I know. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And we'd like to give a special thank you and a shout-out to our associate producers here on MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5, Kay Shaw at ChocoWeeble, Norman Lau at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker, who is no longer from Parts Unknown, at Mark74656, one of my favorite numbers in all of Star Trek.
That's a good registry.
And Mike, we'd like once again to invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.